Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last week, a leaked copy of the Environmental Protection Act's 2018 budget revealed a blueprint of the Trump administration's plan to eviscerate the agency that is responsible for safeguarding public health and protecting the planet. Reuters reports that the EPA's budget would be sliced by 25% to about $6 billion. The budget proposal calls for very deep cuts to a wide range of federal and state projects, including $4.8 million for the EPA's San Francisco Bay program that was established by California Senator Dianne Feinstein back in 2008. The program helps fund a variety of projects, including restoring wetlands and watersheds, reducing polluted runoff, and improving shoreline protection in the San Francisco Bay. These cuts must be approved by the Republican-led Congress. Today's guest, David Lewis, has been at the forefront of the fight for clean water and air and the restoration and expansion of some of the most fragile ecosystems in the San Francisco Bay. David Lewis is executive director of Save the Bay, the largest regional organization working to protect the bay from overdevelopment and pollution. It was founded back in 1961. David Lewis is one of the recipients of the 2017 Bay Nature Local Hero Awards for Conservation Action, and he joins us from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Good morning. What a time to be winning this award.
It's obviously a great honor to get recognized for the work of many, many other people working to protect San Francisco Bay over the decades.
Well, and you've been doing this for such a long time, and thank you so much for your work. You wrote a blog post, or one of your colleagues wrote a blog post about Scott Pruitt when he was confirmed. It was called "A Dark Day for America." And your colleague Cyril Manning wrote, "The scary truth is, as long as Scott Pruitt leads the EPA, we cannot count on our federal government to protect the Bay." What was your reaction? As someone who's dedicated his life to these issues, what was your reaction when Scott Pruitt was confirmed to lead the EPA?
Well, it's just a very early indication that the Trump administration was not going to make environmental protection a priority. Scott Pruitt has been serving as the Attorney General in Oklahoma, and in that capacity, he's actually sued the Environmental Protection Agency numerous times to try to prevent the agency from protecting public health and environmental health, specifically around regulating greenhouse gas emissions that are contributing to climate change. So, like I said, it's an early indication, and since then we've had many more indications that the Trump administration does not have environmental protection as a priority. And in fact, the budget cuts that we're expecting the president to make official this week reflect that as well. Huge proposed cuts to the Environmental Protection Agency, which will make it difficult or impossible for the federal government to enforce the federal laws that protect the water we drink, the air we breathe, and the planet we live on.
Because so much is happening so quickly, it's difficult to keep up with everything. And I wanted to ask you about a story in the New York Times a couple weeks ago called "EPA Head Stacks Agency with Climate Change Skeptics." And according to the story, in the days since Pruitt was confirmed, he has drawn heavily from the staff of his friend and fellow Oklahoma Republican, Senator James Inhofe, long known as Congress's most prominent skeptic of climate science. A former Inhofe chief of staff, Ryan Jackson, will be Scott Pruitt's chief of staff. Another former Inhofe staff member, Byron Brown, will serve as deputy director. Andrew Wheeler, a fossil fuel lobbyist and former Inhofe chief of staff, is a finalist to be Pruitt's deputy, although he requires confirmation to the position by the Senate. So beyond Scott Pruitt, can you also talk about the people that he's surrounding himself with?
Yeah, well, I think the list you just gave speaks for itself. You know, when people take a job with the federal government, they take an oath to uphold the laws and the Constitution of the federal government. And not only are these people ill-equipped to do that, but they're denying the basic laws of physics and science and knowledge, and they're replacing it with slavish or religious adherence to a set of beliefs which are contrary to facts. And so that puts them in an awful position, but it puts us in a worse position because we're not going to be receiving the benefit of the federal government enforcing the laws that are designed to protect all of our health. The most important work that the Environmental Protection Agency does is actually reducing exposure of people to pollution. And that's a way to preserve our lives. So when the federal government declares it's going to go out of that business and puts people who are should be in charge of that responsibility who are refusing to take that action, and we could talk about what their motives might be, the impact on us is to hurt us. It hurts all of us. It hurts our especially the most vulnerable populations among us, people who are sick, people who have asthma, children who are more susceptible to exposure to toxics. And then, of course, all the fish and wildlife that don't have a voice and don't have a vote.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about why this is happening? What are their motives, in your view?
Well, I think you have to follow the money. And there are industries that have been regulated for the sake of protecting our health, for the sake of reducing greenhouse gas emissions that contribute to climate change. First and foremost, that's the fossil fuel industry. The coal industry, the producers of oil and gas who have an interest in us using more of their products and who have been increasingly regulated through appropriate means, through congressional laws that Congress has passed, regulations that agencies have promulgated with public comment, court decisions from the judiciary. All these have contributed to an increasing regime of trying to reduce the amount of greenhouse gases that are emitted. And that has an impact on the bottom line of companies and business owners that stand to make money from that. So that's the primary motive, is to protect the oil and gas industry and the coal industry. There's a history of previous attempts to destroy the Environmental Protection Agency from within, most notably during the Reagan administration, when Ann Gorsuch Burford was put in charge of the agency, incidentally the mother of the current Supreme Court Justice nominee. And she provoked such a counter-reaction that she was fired, and Ronald Reagan actually reached back to rehire the first administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, William Ruckelshaus, who was there during the Nixon administration, to try to resuscitate the agency. The opposition to what Burford was doing came not only from ordinary citizens, but actually from industry that realized that with no regulations in place, they would not be able to operate with certainty. And William Ruckelshaus recently wrote about this experience in the New York Times about a couple of weeks ago, and warned Donald Trump that going down this road again would be devastating and ultimately would not be effective.
So much attention has been focused on what's happening at the federal level for obvious reasons, but as we're learning in this leaked copy of the budget plan, there are going to be deep, deep cuts to a wide range of state projects, including almost $5 million for the EPA's San Francisco Bay Program. This was established back in 2008 by California Senator Dianne Feinstein. Tell us about this program.
Right. Well, within the Environmental Protection Agency, there are a number of geographic programs that were established under the Clean Water Act. Most of them are larger than San Francisco Bay in terms of funding, and they've been operating for a lot longer. Chesapeake Bay, for example, they've been spending $70 or $80 million a year. In the Great Lakes, they've been spending about $300 million a year. Puget Sound in Seattle, about $40 or $50 million a year. And in each of these programs is slightly different. But thanks to Senator Feinstein, about a decade ago, San Francisco Bay started getting about $4 or $5 million a year. That money has been allocated through a competitive grant process to wetland restoration projects here in the Bay to restore marshes and salt ponds, to pollution reduction projects to reduce the amount of pollution that's running off of our streets and roads and into San Francisco Bay, and for a number of other projects. So the leaked budget that you referenced earlier proposes to zero out that program for San Francisco Bay, also make deep cuts to those geographic programs in other areas. The bigger impact beyond that of these proposed budget cuts in grants to states is that right now the states actually have the responsibility for enforcing many of the federal laws. State agencies take on the responsibility from the Environmental Protection Agency for enforcing the Clean Air Act, for enforcing the Clean Water Act, and other laws. And to help the states do that, they get some funding from the federal government to implement those laws. And this budget proposed deep cuts in those areas, as we expect the Trump budget to do in many areas of funds that go to states for health care, for environmental protection, and for other purposes.
Does your organization and others like yours receive funding directly from the EPA?
We have not received any direct government funding from the EPA, I think once about 10 years ago, for some advocacy research, really, on pollution reduction. Some non-governmental organizations do receive funds from the EPA and from this San Francisco Bay program that would be reduced under the Trump budget. But a lot of the funding goes to other government organizations, local governments. The city of San Jose, for example, got a grant from the Environmental Protection Agency to reduce the amount of trash and pollution that was getting into San Francisco Bay from creeks in San Jose. And specifically, they developed an innovative program to try to remove homeless camps from these creeks, where the homeless camps were actually producing a fair amount of trash and human waste that was poisoning the creeks. And the innovation in the program was actually not to just try to kick the homeless populations out, but to try to transition them to housing and other services. So the motivation, primary motivation, was to make the water cleaner and make San Francisco Bay cleaner, but they were actually trying to attack the root cause of the problem, not just what was on the surface.
You know, I was watching a couple of videos yesterday about wetland restoration, and as someone who spends as much time outside as possible and enjoys the beauty that we're all lucky to be surrounded by, I realized that I and so many people probably are not familiar with what goes on behind the scenes to ensure that what we're surrounded by is healthy and clean. And so can you talk a little bit about just how important this money is? Because one of the videos on your site comes from San Francisco Bay Joint Venture, and it focuses on Hunter's Point. And back in the 70s, the Port of San Francisco filled in the bay to begin construction of a new shipping terminal, Pier 98. But the project never went anywhere, and the land was undeveloped. And then in the late 90s, the Port of San Francisco, thanks to citizen advocates, undertook a major restoration of Pier 98 and restored its native wetlands. And today, Heron's Head Park attracts more than 100 migratory birds and resident bird species. Now, those of us that walk around there love it, but, you know, it's easy to kind of forget that so much work went into making this place what it is today.
Yeah, that's a great example, right, in San Francisco, in southeast San Francisco, of the kind of work that's actually going on all around San Francisco Bay. There's an amazing opportunity here to do more of it, sort of through a historical accident. So it's worth going back a little bit in history. And San Francisco Bay was rapidly altered after the gold rush. A lot of the shallow areas on the edge of the bay that were very important ecologically as tidal marshes were diked off. They were diked off and drained. And originally this was done in the North Bay to create hay fields, and in the South Bay to create salt evaporation ponds. Hay was the fuel that fueled San Francisco because everything ran on horses. Yeah. And so hay was a vital crop. And salt was essential for food preservation before we had widespread refrigeration. So these were important cash crops, but in the course of doing that, the bay was significantly altered and made a lot smaller. And then with the rapid urban development that occurred, especially after World War II, the bay was filled in with garbage dumps, and then built on. And so by 1961, when I was born on the peninsula and when, say, the bay was founded, the bay was actually a third smaller because of all of that filling and alteration. And most of what was lost was tidal marshes and mudflats, which are the base of the food chain for the whole ecosystem, for the whole estuary. Well, because of the early work of Save the Bay and activists, filling of the bay was halted. Similar movements here in the Bay Area protected our hillsides and created huge regional park networks, preserved the Marin Headlands and a lot of the shoreline of the bay around San Francisco, preserved Point Reyes and Redwoods. We've really done an amazing job, or at least our parents did, of protecting the urban environment around us. And it's really what makes San Francisco Bay and the Bay Area such a great place to live. You know, there are challenges here because so many people want to live here, obviously, but it's really the heart of our economy. The fact that this is such a livable place, we have such a high quality of life, and it's so easy to get out of the urban environment into open space. And that includes San Francisco Bay. So just to finish the story, come back to the question that you asked, those areas that were not built on but were diked off for hay fields and salt ponds, they can actually be restored to tidal marsh. And over the last two decades, a lot of that work has begun. Some of the salt evaporation ponds were bought back by the state and federal governments. They're in public ownership. They're part of the wildlife refuge. And to restore them, we simply need to let the tides back in. The tides bring mud and seeds of native plants, and these areas revegetate very quickly. The expensive part of that work is building new levees next to where you're letting the bay in so that all the adjacent infrastructure, roads and sewage treatment plants and communities that have grown up near the bay and businesses, they don't get flooded when you let the bay waters back in. So we've got about 4,000 or 5,000 acres of these areas that have been restored to tidal marsh already, and another 30 to 35,000 that are already in public ownership waiting to be restored. And it's a huge opportunity to improve the shoreline. That's not only going to make the bay healthier, but those wetlands actually will protect the shoreline as we experience more sea level rise and extreme weather from climate change. So multiple benefits from all this restoration work going on. Benefits for people and benefits for wildlife.
David Lewis is executive director of Save the Bay, the largest regional organization working to protect the San Francisco Bay from overdevelopment and pollution. It was founded back in 1961, and David is one of the recipients of this year's Bay Nature Local Hero Awards for Conservation Action. The event will take place. It's an awards dinner on Sunday, March 26th at the UCSF Mission Bay Conference Center, and you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. David has been at the forefront of the fight for clean water and air and the restoration and expansion of some of the most fragile ecosystems in the San Francisco Bay. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on what we're currently facing right now? The Trump administration plans to slice the EPA's overall budget by 25%, and that's going to affect all of us directly. The proposal calls for very deep cuts to state projects, including almost $5 million for the EPA's San Francisco Bay program. And this program helps fund a lot of projects, restoring wetlands and watersheds, reducing polluted runoff, and improving shoreline protection. So if you have any questions or comments, we'd love to hear from you, 866-798-8255. If you are a conservationist, what do you think of all of these cuts? How are groups going to respond? How are you responding? What do you think is most effective? Because this almost $5 million is so, so crucial to all of these projects and to making sure that the places that we love and cherish remain clean and available for all of us. 866-798-8255. David, you talked about why wetland restoration is so important. And I hope that if you're interested in this, you check out the website because there's great videos, great explanations. It results in clean water, helps curb global warming, habitat for sensitive species, protects communities from floods and sea level rise, open space and recreation so everyone can enjoy these spaces. How are groups like yours going to continue this work if, in fact, these deep cuts go through?
Well, we're very fortunate to live someplace where there's a lot of public support for the environment and deep love for the Bay. And we're also a fairly well-off region. There are a lot of resources here. And I think it's significant that people in the Bay Area have actually already stepped up to help with this effort. For one thing, with Save the Bay and other organizations, individuals can get directly involved in a hands-on way with restoring these tidal marshes in areas near where they live. And you can find out how to volunteer and do that work on our website, which is savesfbay.org. And we've been actually doing that kind of work for about 20 years. And not only is it actually helping restore habitat in these areas along the shoreline, it's actually a great way for people to get educated and invested in the resource, learn more about it, and learn how they can help. But even more than that, just last June, voters in the San Francisco Bay Area voted to tax ourselves. We passed a parcel tax, Measure AA. It's the first time ever that people in all nine Bay Area counties have voted on a regional tax. And that's going to raise about $500 million over the next 20 years, which will go in grants to these tidal marsh restoration projects all around the Bay. That'll produce all the benefits that you mentioned. So that's just going to cost property owners in the Bay Area $12 a year, a dollar a month. And because we have so many people in the Bay Area and because we voted by a supermajority to pass this tax, it's going to generate $500 million, even though property owners will only be paying a dollar a month to get this work done. So that's one advantage, I guess, that we have as a region in a time when the federal government is already pulling back from their commitment to do this work. We have a supportive regional population. We have a supportive state. State resource bond monies have also contributed to San Francisco Bay restoration over the years, and there may be another state resources and park bond on the ballot in November of 2018. We're working really hard to make sure that that includes more money for San Francisco Bay.
And talking about Measure AA, which will generate about $500 million over 20 years for critical tidal marsh restoration projects, I've read that these efforts were proposed under the assumption that the federal government would have to be a willing partner and help put forward one-third of the $1.5 billion that it's estimated to cost to restore 35,000 acres. What happens if the EPA refuses to take part in this project?
Well, that was the goal, that the state, federal, and local funding sources would each contribute about a third to the overall cost of about $1.5 billion over the next 20 or 30 years to do this tidal marsh restoration work. The impact if the federal government does not step up and provide that third is just that less total work will be done and the wetland restoration won't happen as quickly. The bottom line is San Francisco Bay needs more resources from the federal government, not fewer, and not just for this tidal marsh restoration work. The federal government pulling back will not put at risk the funds from Measure AA. We'll still be, as a region, making that investment, and we hope the state will make a similar investment. And we won't give up trying to get the federal government to do it. It's just really unlikely in the next couple of years. But hopefully that the fortunes will turn. I'll just mention that we've been talking about the funding needed for tidal marsh restoration, but the Bay has huge additional needs for reducing pollution, most of which is not coming from factories and refineries anymore, but is coming from our streets, which in most of the Bay Area drain directly into San Francisco Bay without being screened or treated. In San Francisco, the stormwater that goes down the gutter into the storm drain. That is mostly treated through the sewage treatment plants. But in the rest of the Bay Area, it drains directly into the bay. So we need funding to help cities reduce the amount of trash that's getting into San Francisco Bay. And we have a lot of other needs in the area of water quality.
And after the break, we'll talk about something more positive, and that is the plastic ban that passed, even though millions of dollars was spent by the plastic industry to stop this ban. Today, we're speaking with David Lewis. He's executive director of Save the Bay, the largest regional organization working to protect the San Francisco Bay from overdevelopment and pollution. And he's going to be honored at this year's Bay Nature Dinner. He won the Local Hero Award for Conservation Action, and you can find more information about that event at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
There are many ways you can take part in the conversation on Your Call on the phone, by sending an email to feedback at yourcallradio.org, or by going to the yourcallradio.org website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by phone, call toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, it's World Have Your Say from the BBC.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about the new film Chinese Exclusion Act. It examines the 1882 law that was established after decades of anti-immigrant rhetoric and violence against Chinese immigrants. This was the only federal legislation in U.S. history to single out and name a specific race and nationality for exclusion from immigration and citizenship. So we'll talk about this law and how it affected attitudes toward race, culture, politics, and society. And this is so relevant for today, for obvious reasons. Today we're joined by David Lewis, executive director of Save the Bay, the largest regional organization working to protect the San Francisco Bay from overdevelopment and pollution. On March 26th, David will be recognized by Bay Nature. He won their Local Hero Award for Conservation Action. It's a dinner. It'll be taking place at the UCSF Mission Bay Conference Center in San Francisco. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the incredible work that is done in the San Francisco Bay and how it will be affected by the Trump administration's budget proposal, which calls for deep cuts to a wide range of federal and state projects, including almost $5 million for the EPA's San Francisco Bay program. And this program funds a number of projects: restoration, restoring wetlands and watersheds, reducing polluted runoff, improving shoreline protection. And we'd love to hear from you. If you have any questions or comments about this, if you work on these issues, if you're a conservationist, how are your groups planning to respond to these cuts? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And if you have any questions or you'd like to tell stories about how this money has been used, we'd love to hear from you. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. David, you brought up plastic bags and pollution. And last year was a great year for your organization and others like yours because the plastic bag ban passed. You overcame millions of dollars in spending by the plastic industry. Talk about the significance of this plastic bag ban.
Well, plastic bags are one of the most pervasive items, they have been, in trash that's found in stormwater running off into the bay and into the ocean. Plastic persists in the environment for basically forever once it gets out there, and this has a negative effect on fish and wildlife, not only from animals that eat the plastic, but also the toxins that leach from the plastic over time. So this is also a great example of how local action can have an impact and grow to a larger scale. There have been proposals for the last decade to ban the distribution of single-use plastic bags. Mostly these come from grocery stores. There have been proposals to ban it statewide through the state legislature, and they would not be successful because the plastic industry, which is part of the petroleum industry, was very successful in beating those back through powerful lobbying in Sacramento. So we looked at this situation in San Francisco Bay, and we believed that we could accomplish the same thing going city by city and county by county. So starting about 7 years ago, actually San Francisco was the first city to put a ban on some of these bags. San Jose, we worked with the city of San Jose, which is the largest city in the Bay Area in population, and passed a much more stringent ban on single-use plastic shopping bags, basically from all retailers. And then we worked with cities throughout the Bay Area, and by a couple of years ago, we actually had 85% of the population in the Bay Area living someplace where there was a restriction on these bags. And you already are seeing far fewer of them out in the environment. The effect of our work locally and the work of local groups in Los Angeles to do the same thing changed the politics in the state legislature. The state legislature was able to pass a law, and Governor Brown signed it, banning plastic bags, single-use plastic bags, from food-serving, food-providing stores throughout the state. Then the plastic bag industry spent several million dollars collecting signatures to put a referendum on the ballot challenging that law. And so the law, which was signed by Governor Brown in 2014, actually didn't take effect because it was placed on the 2016 ballot. And then last November, Prop 67, we were able to secure the plastic bag ban and get voters throughout the state to pass it. So now it's a law, it's going into effect, and we're already seeing fewer bags in the environment throughout the state.
The numbers are just incredible. On your website, you report that Californians use 19 billion plastic bags annually. We've got, what is it, about 34 million people in our state now?
Yeah, 34, and that statistic is from a few years ago. And most of those bags, I have to say, are used for about a minute.
This is amazing.
To carry groceries to the car.
Wow.
And then, although there have been efforts to try to encourage people to recycle those bags, and although a small number of them are actually reused, most of them go straight into the trash and straight into the landfill. Or, because they're light, they get blown around in the environment, and they end up, you see them in the trees, and then they get into the water, and then they get into the food chain. And so those numbers are going down dramatically because with a few exceptions, like restaurants, takeout food, something very wet that you would need a plastic bag for the most part, people are shifting very quickly to bringing their own bags to the grocery store and reusing them over and over again, washing them when they get dirty, and saving all that waste and preventing all that trash from getting out into the bay.
And it's always a good idea. My local corner store, I love it. But to get produce, they still have the plastic bags. So I keep asking them to try to bring in compostable bags. So if any of your stores or anywhere you go still uses plastic, ask them to use compostable bags. And this is another great statistic. On a positive note, your website reports that just 1 year after the bag ban went into effect, San Jose reported 89% fewer plastic bags in its trash screens and 69% fewer plastic bags in its creeks.
Right, and that was when the local ban went into effect about 5 years ago. That was what they discovered after just the first year. So we know that some trash can be stopped at the source because there are alternatives. And plastic bags, great example of that. Styrofoam takeout food containers is another area where we've worked with San Francisco and other cities because there are replacements that are not as destructive in the environment. They're either compostable or they're recyclable, whereas styrofoam breaks down into small pieces and then those pieces persist forever as microtrash.
David Lewis is Executive Director of Save the Bay, the largest regional organization working to protect the Bay from overdevelopment and pollution. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from James in San Francisco. Hi, James. Welcome to the show. Hi, do we have James? James, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. I have questions regarding Coyote Creek. We all have images of the recent flooding. Does the creek end up in the bay? How many creeks in the San Jose area flow into the bay? And are they monitored for vegetation, brush growth, and trash?
Thank you.
Yeah, that's a great question. So Coyote Creek does drain into San Francisco Bay. It drains all the way from close to Morgan Hill and runs north through the Coyote Valley next to 101 and 880, and it empties into the bay near the San Jose-Milpitas border. The flooding along Coyote Creek came about because the creek has been channelized into a very narrow channel. There were very high flows because of water being released from the Anderson Dam Reservoir, also near Morgan Hill. So though the other large creek system that drains through San Jose is the Guadalupe River, Guadalupe Creek, which goes right through downtown San Jose. Also Los Gatos Creek, which drains from the reservoir along Highway 17. So there are creeks throughout San Jose, and they're mostly actually not buried underground, as they are in many cities throughout the Bay Area where they're in culverts. So these are open creeks. They are monitored, the vegetation and the flood control responsibilities are actually shared by the City of San Jose and the Santa Clara Valley Water District. There have been some improvements made to those creeks over the years to try to reduce the risk of flooding. And we talked earlier about homeless encampments along these creeks. So those are also a source of trash, as is illegal dumping. The creeks are mostly conduits for trash and pollution getting into the bay. We haven't had very many examples of flooding along those creeks. But it is an increasing concern because, in addition to sea level rise, one of the impacts of climate change is that we're going to get more intense storms more frequently, where a lot of rain is dropped in one place at one time. And when we are in a heavily urbanized environment where a lot of the land is covered with concrete and impermeable pavement, when you get a big storm, you get a lot of runoff quickly, and that can overwhelm the creeks. So one of the things that Save the Bay is taking on and will be working on for the next several years is working with cities to try to address this problem. And one of the best ways to do that is through green infrastructure, changing the way we have water flow off of our streets and other property so that the stormwater doesn't flow as quickly and as much, and more of it is allowed to infiltrate into the ground. And you slow down those heavy flows. Not only do you reduce the risk of flooding, but you also reduce the amount of pollution that's getting all the way into the bay. So this is one of several ways that we can make our cities more adaptable to climate change, make our cities more bay smart. There's a lot of population growth still coming in the San Francisco Bay Area, and we want to accommodate that in ways that don't harm the bay and don't harm the environment.
Well, thank you for calling in, James. Let's go next to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg.
Hello. A couple of comments and questions. I shop at a farmer's market where I live in Palo Alto, and I also occasionally shop at Whole Foods. I've talked to both of them about not using plastic bags because they both use plastic bags, and at the farmer's market, it just doesn't look like many people are very conscious about this. And I asked them once at the farmer's market, hey, can you get something that you might be able to provide, or ask people who are selling to get something to provide that's an alternative to plastic bags? And the guy that was in charge of the gave me a long explanation about how even if we went to something that was recyclable or whatever, it wouldn't make that much difference because it's made from certain materials, blah, blah, blah. So the upshot of that was that you're not going to get any very far. And I don't know if you have any options for that. I try to get multiple uses out of my plastic bags if I can and use alternatives, but they're more costly. The last thing I wanted to ask you about was this. I don't see any advertising on television, whether it's public television or commercial television, about many of these environmental products or issues. And I'm wondering if there's any way to do that, because if I go to a commercial just channel and just look at it for a while, I'm going to see cars still being advertised that are getting 18 miles to the gallon. So I can't figure out why there isn't more environmental stuff advertising. Money is probably a big factor, but even in the public interest to get public television to do that kind of thing.
Greg, you mean focusing on these issues
as a
news story?
Exactly.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, during the election, and thank you, Greg, during the election, David, we talked about the fact that the environment barely came up. I mean, it barely was even asked during the debates.
Right. Well, all the polls show that people care deeply about the environment, mm-hmm. and when they perceive that there's a direct or new threat to it, then it's elevated in terms of their concern. We see that in San Francisco Bay on when we've had an oil spill or a sewage spill. Most of the time we take the Bay for granted, but when we see that direct threat, then it becomes more prominent for us. So, I think the television networks, those are money-making enterprises, and the ownership, the corporate ownership of those networks might have some impact on what gets shown, but news and media is much more diversified now. People are getting their news from other places. And I will say that if you're spending any time online on Facebook or in other places where the cookies in your browser know something about your interest and how you shop, you may view that as, invasive or pervasive, but it also means that the advertisements that you are shown tend to align with your interests. So if you're somebody that's shopped for replacements for plastic bags or bought some reusable bags, you're more likely to see advertising about alternatives to those bags. I will just say on the farmers markets, there are some really great organizations that support and encourage the farmers markets. In San Francisco, CUESA is one of those that brings you the farmers market at the Ferry Building and some others throughout the region. They've been very effective over the years at promoting environmentally sustainable activities and products. So the organics movement that now has organic foods being sold in even in Target, that started with the farmers markets movement. And actually, the efforts to restrict plastic bags and to encourage more reusable bags, that happens first at the farmers markets too. So these are great places for education. And I encourage the caller to talk to some of these organizations about how they can educate those merchants who don't seem to be as aligned with the program.
And what would you suggest for people who hear that compostable bags are no better than plastic bags?
Well, the effectiveness of compostables is entirely dependent on whether you get them into a compost situation. So, the shortcoming of compostable bags is if they're treated the same way the plastic bags were as trash. If they get into a landfill and they're in an anaerobic environment, they're not going to break down. If they get into the cold water of the Pacific Ocean, they're not going to break down and be composted. So as with any potentially compostable material, it all depends on whether you're getting them into an effective composter, either through your city or in your backyard.
We have a related question from Henry, who writes, the plastic bag ban is great, but what can be done about the shiny Mylar bags that juice and chips are sold in nowadays? In my neighborhood in the East Bay, he writes, I see hundreds of these in the gutters.
Yeah, well, there's still a lot of trash being produced. San Francisco's actually been at the forefront after many years of effort by the Department of Environment to reduce its trash stream by diverting recyclables, by diverting compostables, and getting down to a really small percentage of the trash that's actually trash and has to go to landfill. And most of it is packaging and disposable items. So there's a lot that local communities can do to reduce the waste stream, but in the end, these decisions will have to be made by state and federal governments about the limits of non-reusable packaging.
And Greg also brought up cars, and because gas prices are coming down, the sale of large cars is going up. It happens almost all the time in the United States. And I wanted to ask you just quickly about the vehicle fuel efficiency rules that were locked in at the end of the Obama administration. And Reuters reports that Donald Trump is set to review those rules. He's going to meet with automaker chiefs this week. And this is going to be really affecting California. We don't know what's going to happen yet. In fact, Wired has a story called "The Trump EPA Wants to Gut California's Clean Air Rules, Prepare for War." So what are your thoughts about this? What do you think is going to happen? Because California has very strict rules when it comes to vehicle emissions. Do you think the Trump administration can take on these rules?
Well, I certainly think they're going to try. And again, it's the same financial interest that's behind this. It's the oil and gas industry that obviously is going to sell less fuel if cars are more fuel efficient. It would be a terrible mistake to go back. One of the biggest leaps we've had in fuel efficiency is as a result of the Obama administration's actions. You know, when we had the financial crisis and the auto companies were about to go belly up, the federal government stepped in, saved the auto industry in the United States. And while the federal government owned the auto companies, was able to put in place these standards for increasing fuel efficiency of the vehicle fleet over time to reduce our dependence on foreign oil, to reduce the amount of greenhouse gases we were emitting. And that's been a huge boon. In a way, the federal government was catching up to what California, which has the authority under the Clean Air Act to have its own standards, what California was able to do and some states were previously able to follow. So it'd be a huge mistake to go back. I do think the Trump administration has already signaled that they're going to try to do this. There will be legal battles over it in the courts, including over California's authority under the Clean Air Act to set its own standards. And it's one of several big mistakes that are going to hurt public health and are going to hurt our economy, actually, as well, that the Trump administration seems poised to make.
Well, we should be getting news about what it plans to do in the coming days. We have time for one more caller. Let's hear from Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I was looking at the EPA website, and I was particularly interested in learning about injection wells. These injection wells that the industries use to put either hazardous or non-hazardous material in underneath, and what they consider aquifers that they have exemptions for, because they're aquifers that it supposedly are no longer in use or will not be in use in the future. Now, my question has to do with San Francisco in particular, because we get our water from Hetch Hetchy, so I think we have a very limited number of aquifers, and I don't think we use any of them for drinking water. Does that mean that we have a lot of aquifer exemptions, and therefore companies can inject things inside those aquifers and potentially harm our bay and our water?
I don't know for sure where any aquifer exemptions are in place in the immediate San Francisco Bay Area, in the city of San Francisco or the nine counties. But most of those counties, with the exception of Solano, where there are some gas wells out in the Suisun Marsh near the Delta, most of those counties, I'm not aware of active mining for oil or gas that's taking place in those areas. So there may not be any local exemptions, but this is actually an area where the state of California has recently developed some changes in policies because of all the attention to fracking and the environmental impacts of fracking. So again, this was a sort of a hidden environmental disaster that was not visible to as many people, but thanks to the work of the Sierra Club and other organizations, more of this activity has been brought to light. San Francisco does get its drinking water from Hetch Hetchy, but the city and the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission have recently started looking at ways of developing more local self-reliance and not relying entirely on water that's coming from Hetch Hetchy, which is expensive to pump and move to us. A lot of it is gravity-fed, but to process. And so the city is actually trying to recharge aquifers and extract groundwater from those aquifers and blend it with a Hetch Hetchy water. And that's a fairly recent development and experiment.
And David, we're almost out of time, but we have a good question from Ron. What about what seems to be the most ubiquitous throwaway item of all, the single-use coffee cup spilling out of trash receptacles on a daily basis?
Yeah, well, I mean, more coffee companies are using cups that are compostable. So diverting that waste from trash to compostable is one approach. Many people are bringing their own coffee cups to coffee stores or making their coffee at home like I do.
And the lids, are the lids recyclable or is it best to ask for a cup without the lid?
I think it varies. I think some of the lids are recyclable, others are not. Hmm. Whether they get recycled is another question. And I would never tell somebody not to use a lid on their hot coffee if it means they might burn themselves.
Well, so. That's true. Bring your own cup. Because coffee stores will now, coffee shops will now pour the coffee in someone's cup, right?
I think many of the stores will do that, yes.
Yeah. All right. Final thoughts, David, as people are really grappling with how they can get involved and, you know, what do you think is most effective at this point?
Well, I think we certainly need to resist the moves the Trump administration is preparing to make on the environment. People can do that by being directly in touch with the government officials. They can also sign up at savesfbay.org for alerts. But in the end, I think in addition to resisting those federal efforts, we need to do as much as we can locally to improve and protect our environment. Local groups are very effective at doing that work, and a lot of the cities in the Bay Area want to help.
David Lewis is Executive Director of Save the Bay, the largest regional organization working to protect San Francisco Bay from overdevelopment and pollution. He'll be honored at Bay Nature's Local Hero Awards Dinner on Sunday, March 26th at the UCSF Mission Bay Conference Center in San Francisco. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. David, thank you for joining us, and thank you for your important work.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation about the film Chinese Exclusion Act, which examines the 1882 law that was established after decades of anti-immigrant rhetoric and violence against Chinese immigrants. The film's directors will join us to talk about how the law affected attitudes toward race, culture, politics, and society. Your Call is produced here at KALW. Malihe Razazan produced today's show. You can email us feedback at yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for joining us. We'll